From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton's voice is given out. It was strained during last night's State of the Union speech. He's had to cancel a talk at a Washington, D.C. junior high school. The president did meet with congressional leaders this morning to discuss health care. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton huddled with top congressional Democrats to plot strategy on health care this morning. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt was predicting that all three of the president's legislative priorities for the year, crime, welfare reform, and health care reform, were within reach. But Republican leader Robert Dole predicted Clinton's health care plan was in trouble. Dole said the president is going to have to drop some aspects of his plan, including price controls, employer mandates, and the mandatory health alliances. But those are precisely the things the administration has signaled it's willing to give up. However, last night Clinton said he wasn't willing to compromise over his bottom-line demand for universal health care coverage. Waving a pen in the air, he told Congress he'd veto any health care bill that came to his desk without a comprehensive package of benefits guaranteed for all Americans. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The United States will send Patriot missiles to South Korea, although it's not clear when. Defense Undersecretary Frank Wisner says anti-missile batteries will be sent to help reassure South Koreans who worry North Korea will launch several Scud missiles at them. North Korea is arguing over inspection of its nuclear facilities. The United Nations wants to make sure that North Korea's nuclear facilities are peaceful. Wisner says the Patriots are part of sensible defense preparations. He also says North Korea shouldn't see the missiles as a threat because they are only defensive. An educator in Charlotte, North Carolina, is this year's winner of the National Principal of the Year Award. From Charlotte, Kevin Marks of member station WFAE reports.
Judges say 35-year-old Ann Clark is this year's award recipient because she focuses on the students at Alexander Graham Middle School in Charlotte. Clark says she runs her school on the basis of fire prevention as opposed to firefighting.
We have no hats, no gum, no Walkman radios, a lot of things that I think set a tone that's more focused on academics and less casual and relaxed, perhaps.
The award means $10,000 for Clark's school. She wants to use the money to take her 754 students off campus for a week to examine issues of racism and peer pressure. Clark beat out 150 others for the award, which is sponsored by the National Association of Secondary School Principals and Metropolitan Life Insurance. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Marks in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Scott Paper says it will cut its workforce 25%. That's 8,300 jobs. Scott says it wants to reduce its costs like its competitors. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 4 points at 3,899. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Political extremist Lyndon LaRouche is out of jail. He served 5 years out of 15 on federal charges of mail fraud and conspiracy. He says he'll run again for president in 1996. LaRouche has run for president in every election since 1976. He constantly warns of impending financial disaster and makes charges against prominent people and institutions. The ruling coalition in Japan and the opposition party have made little progress toward a compromise on political reform legislation. It's prolonging political uncertainty in the country. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports from Tokyo.
The parliament must decide the fate of Prime Minister Hosokawa's reform legislation by the end of the week. Many political experts here say the bills are unlikely to pass. The reforms would reapportion election districts and tighten campaign funding to reduce political corruption. A special parliamentary committee met today for the first time to try to hammer out a compromise. But the committee met for just 5 minutes and will resume discussions tomorrow, pushing negotiations right up to the deadline. Theories abound here about how the political landscape might change if the bills fail to pass. But the situation is too fluid because of shifting political alliances within the coalition and the opposition. Hosokawa said today he will not resign if the bills fail, but it's unclear how long he could stay in power if the legislation does not pass. In Tokyo, I'm Marjorie Sun.
United Nations officials say civilians north of Sarajevo mobbed a food convoy today after somebody started shooting. At least 6 Bosnian police escorts were wounded. Some 200 people were waiting for the food. A UN spokesman says somebody opened fire from a window inside a nearby home. The officials say this is the first time they know of that someone has fired at a relief convoy. Relief convoys have been suspended in that part of Bosnia. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jerry Conlon spent 15 years in British prisons for an IRA bombing he had nothing to do with. His autobiography is the basis of the new movie In the Name of the Father. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Jerry Conlon. Then we'll talk with the director of In the Name of the Father, Jim Sheridan. The movie stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Jerry Conlon. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Critic, the new primetime cartoon series created by the former head writers of The Simpsons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, In the Name of the Father, stars Daniel Day-Lewis as a young Irishman wrongly convicted of being an IRA terrorist. The movie is based on the autobiography of my guest Jerry Conlon. Conlon, who grew up in Belfast, was accused with three friends of bombing a pub in Guildford, England. They became known as the Guildford Four. They were sentenced to life in 1975. Conlon's aunt, Annie McGuire, and her family were convicted of making bombs. Conlon's father, who was convicted as a co-conspirator, died in prison in 1980. After his death, there were calls to review the case. It was finally reopened in 1989 after Conlon's lawyer discovered that the prosecution had suppressed evidence which proved everyone's innocence. On today's show, we're going to hear from Jerry Conlon and the director of the new film about him, Jim Sheridan. I asked Jerry Conlon why he thinks he was accused of the bombing.
I think I was accused of the bombing because the British police were in a state of fear, and Britain had developed a siege mentality down to an IRA mainland campaign. And it was a question of rounding up people, and my name was one of the names that was thrown into the hat, and subsequently I was arrested, and I seemed to fit the bill for them. I came from West Belfast. I was unemployed. They tortured me. I signed a confession.
Why was your name in the hopper? Why was your name on the list?
Well, I was working with some friends in London who happened to be arrested, and they'd been brutalised in the police station, and it had to be seen to be believed, the atmosphere and the amount of brutality that was in the police station, to understand why people could confess to something they didn't do. And obviously these people had been given such a bad time that they admitted something they didn't do. And of course, when you get that sort of situation, it's sort of roller coasters. And to stop the brutality, all sorts of names be threw up, people who they know and people who they know well and people who they know very vaguely.
One of the things you got to understand is that if you were being interrogated and if you knew members of the IRA, and if you were not in the IRA, the last thing you could do is give their names because you're afraid of them. So people were actually looking, when they themselves broke down, they were looking to find people who they thought it was ridiculous would be tried.
So they'd name names that were absurd.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, yeah.
That's why they named Annie McGuire, because her house was decorated with Churchill and Queen
with
of
British
England.
British memorabilia. You right. know, they had Annie McGuire had pictures of the Queen and the bust of Winston Churchill and that. And it was so ludicrous that these people could actually be involved in something like that. And that's how their names were brought up. And it was a, you know, when you're being tortured and a name crops up, it's very easy to develop it into a real thing.
Jerry Conlon, at your trial, you write in your memoir that you almost thought the defense should have brought up that the IRA didn't want undisciplined idiots like you in its ranks.
The police should have investigated our background before they brought us to trial, and they would have known
our
defense wouldn't have needed to bring that sort of material up.
What was it about you and the IRA that didn't go together?
Well, probably rock and roll. I grew up in a house that was full of music, and there was a rock and roll background to it. And I don't know, maybe I was sort of like one of the lone hippies where I came from, and all I wanted was a good time, and I didn't perceive a good time to be standing on corners checking out army foot patrols with the possibility of shooting them. I preferred much going to a dance hall or going to the betting shop and having the betting horses and chasing women. You know, that was my priorities. My priorities was never for United Ireland. I became politicised later on, you know, and it was through imprisonment that happened.
You were also a small-time thief. What did the IRA think of people like you who robbed to get some extra money?
Well, I didn't regard myself. I regarded myself as a small-time survivor, you know. Like, mm-hmm. Unemployment was exclusively one-sided where I came from, you know. Discrimination in jobs and housing is now well known, but in 1969 it wasn't. So, like, you were having a lot of bombed-out places with all sorts of sellable goods in it, and I thought I was just doing a good job for myself, saying I couldn't get normal employment.
In the movie, there's a scene where someone from the IRA is about to kneecap you, about to shoot you in the knee, because you were causing such chaos by stealing. But then in the movie, your father comes in and talks the IRA out of it and rescues you. Did something like that actually happen?
On several occasions. My father was a well-respected member of the community. He was very gentle and very kind, and he was also... For the people who did have a job in West Belfast, he used to fill out the tax forms for them, you know, and he was recognised as a gentle and kind person. And I fell foul of the IRA several times through taking scrap metal to sell from buildings, through what they termed antisocial behaviour, like, and that would come under the term of doing Rod Stewart impressions on the Falls Road, you know.
Doing Rod Stewart impressions would be antisocial behaviour?
Well, if you sang like I did, it would be termed antisocial.
No, what did you and other friends of yours who were apolitical think of the IRA?
We didn't really think anything of them. You know, the whole thing was, it was 1969, Woodstock had happened, there was this whole start of the glam rock era, and all of a sudden you're caught up in a war, you know, and you either joined the IRA or you didn't join the IRA. And my house was full of religious pictures of Jesus Christ and the Blessed Virgin Mary, when most other houses were filled with pictures of 1916 Republican heroes. And I didn't, I had no intention. I was caught up in a rock and roll theme. I was just a young kid who wanted to have a good time, and I found myself walking a precarious tightrope between these two elements who were at war with each other.
So when you were picked up for the Guildford pub bombings, what did the authorities do to you to get you to confess?
Well, the first thing they did was they asked me my name, and when I said my name was Jerry Conlon, this police officer hit me in the face and broke my nose. So that was the start of it. And then I went through a further 6 days of torture. I was beaten every day. I was held naked. The clothes that I was originally arrested in were destroyed by the police because they were saturated with my own blood. And obviously the police had destroyed them because they didn't want them to be exhibited at my court appearance. I was held naked. I was given no food. There was policemen running about with guns. There was Alsatian dogs prowling the corridors. It was a whole time of absolute terror in the police station. I was taken out from the police station. I had a gun put to my head. I was told that my family were going to be murdered. You know, like, it was just incredible. Like, I couldn't believe. When I left Belfast on the plane, I was convinced that I was going to be treated correctly, that English policemen, rather than Northern Ireland policemen, would see how nonsensical this was. You know, like, here was this kid from West Belfast who could be checked out on a computer, whose family had not been touched by the Troubles. There was internment, which meant people were arrested and detained without trial for, it could be anything from a month to 2 or 3 years. And yet my family had never been involved. They had never had their home searched. So, like, if the police just had took a bit of time and checked out our backgrounds, you know, they could have seen, like, how stupid it was in arresting the type of people they were arresting. They were arresting people from squats who were like New Age travellers of today.
When you were arrested and interrogated, this was right after the Prevention of Terrorism Act was passed, which enabled the authorities to keep somebody suspected of terrorism for 7 days without legal representation. So that was the period when you were arrested. Can you remember for us the moment when you decided, okay, I'll sign this confession?
When Wally Simmons, the police officer, and Christopher Rowe, who was the assistant chief constable, they picked up the phone and spoke to the policeman who had brutalized me in Springfield Road Police Station and said, Conlon hasn't made a confession. We want an accident to happen to his family. And then they started going on mentioning members of my family. And, like, I knew that the threat was a real one because so many civilians had been killed in such strange circumstances by the security forces, and none of the security forces had ever been held answerable. So, like, I knew that the threat was totally real. And although I was being brutalized within the police station, it was then taken out of my hands. I couldn't deal with the likes of my father, my mother, or my sisters being murdered because I wouldn't make a confession. And I thought that the confession would never have stood up in court because of the background I had.
Did you name names, other people's names, when you were asked to confess?
We all named names. We all named the most ludicrous names we could imagine. We named people who were alcoholics, people who were drug addicts. We named every sort of name, you know?
Did you mention your aunt?
I did mention my aunt, you know? And I was only a kid at the time. You've got to remember that we were all 18, 19, and 20 years of age. None of us had ever been in this type of situation before. We were being brutalized. We were being terrified.
Yeah.
We were being held naked. You had very immature kids, you know?
So your aunt and her family were actually imprisoned for several years and found guilty of being bomb makers, of running a bomb-making factory out of their homes.
That's right. But my other aunt and uncle had been arrested a couple of days previous to that, you know, and the fact is that the police fabricated evidence against my Aunt Annie and my Uncle Paddy and against my father and against my cousins. You know, they went and done a test called the TLC test, the thin layer chromatography test. And once they got the results of that, they said that there was confirmation that they'd been handling explosives, and immediately they burned the samples.
What happens is, basically, we all assume in our own ignorance that if we were in a police station, A, we wouldn't sign a confession,
mm-hmm.
and B, we wouldn't tell on our, you know, friends or whatever. But if most people were terrorized, and it doesn't even have to be such beatings, you know, it can be psychological. Most people would confess. It's something they don't want to admit to. And what happens consequently is we make that act, which is totally understandable, into something wrong. So we're victimizing the victims all over again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, the frightening thing is not that these people were framed by the police. I can understand that if I can't condone it. But the frightening thing is that the police could think that these people were the IRA. That the police were so blind to, you know, both what the IRA is and what Irish people are, that they thought these ordinary hippies on acid were bombers. It's a frightening concept.
My guest is Jerry Conlon. His autobiography is the subject of the new movie In the Name of the Father. The film's director, Jim Sheridan, is also with us. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jerry Conlon. His autobiography is the basis of the new film In the Name of the Father. Director Jim Sheridan is also with us. Jerry, how did your father end up going to prison?
Well, my father had this tremendous love for me, you know, and My mother was the only person in the house who was working at the time, and she couldn't afford to take time off to come and organize the solicitor. But what the thing that's important here is that my father actually went to the police station in Belfast, where I had been detained and beaten, and he got the police to make a call to Scotland Yard that they announced that he was coming over and where he would be staying, which is my aunt's house. And that Scotland Yard police said, yes, of course Mr. Conlon can come over to get legal representation for his son. And when my father arrived in the country, he was in the country 4 hours and they arrested him. Now, is that the actions of someone who's got something to hide or who's conspiratorial? They actually called Scotland Yard and warned him in advance that he's coming. And what happened was because they needed to build a case. And I think it went a bit further than that. I think it was like the British police send to the Irish community. If you have the IRA in your midst, we are going to find you guilty as well. And therefore, they terrorised a minority community. You know, that's the reality of the situation.
So your father came to visit you and to try to get you good legal representation.
My father came,
and he was picked up. When he
My father came to meet police at Scotland Yard to find out what was happening to me, and he met them in the most bizarre circumstances as a suspect who was then being charged.
So, were you on good terms with your father then?
I had the relationship that most young people have with their father, you know, which is a rebellious one. He was the head of the household who laid down laws for the household, and. Obviously, being a teenager, I rebelled against him from time to time, but there was a great love between me and my father.
So how has your relationship changed when you ended up in jail together?
Well, it went from extreme to extreme, you know. Like, my father believed in one course of action to deal with trying to prove our innocence, and I believed in another. And at times we came into conflict about it. But, like, there was always this love, and I got to see my father beyond the superficial father that most children see. I got to know him as a human being. I got to see a spiritual side of him, and I got to be able to dip from the well of strength that he had inside him, you know.
In your book, you write that before your father died, he said to you, and your father died in prison. When he got to prison, he had, I think, tuberculosis and a heart condition. So he was
he hadn't got a heart condition.
He didn't
my father.
Have heart, okay.
The thing is, my father would have probably been alive today if it hadn't been for the mild treatment in prison. You know, like, if you would have been, if you had treated a dog in the fashion that the British prison authorities treated my father, you would have been indicted. My father was treated brutally at the hands of the British.
You write that your father said to you before he died, my death is going to clear your name, then you clear mine. Did his death have an effect on your case?
I think the death of my father reopened this case. It drew enormous interest to the case, and I think my father's death was instrumental in my release. And I think since I've been out of prison, I've campaigned ferociously on behalf of innocent victims of miscarriages of justice, and not only in the Irish community, but in the black community and the Asian community. And I have gone out and told the world what's happened to my father, and I'm just trying to do my best now for other people who are left behind in prison suffering the same injustice.
So you think even in death your father was helping you?
Oh, I know in death. My father gave his life to not only clear my name, but to clear the names of the likes of Annie McGuire in that door. Without my father's death, this case would never have been reopened.
Annie McGuire,
he gave the ultimate sacrifice.
In your book you write, I'd gone away as a kid, an absolute menace. I came out of prison more mature. How did you mature in prison?
Well, I think 15 years anywhere. Like,
yeah, really?
No matter where you are, I think if you're in a zoo, you mature to some extent, you know, to some extent.
Yeah.
And what happened was I started educating myself while I was in prison, no thanks to the prison authorities, I might add, but through my family sending me in books and all sorts of reading material and newspapers and that they sacrificed bits of their savings for. And I think it was just a growing up process. It's a very difficult place to become mature. But it happens to everyone. You do become mature. Time's the master.
Three of your friends, plus your aunt and her family, were imprisoned for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Did they all survive emotionally? and physically?
No, I think everybody's been deeply scarred by this trauma. And I, you know, my lawyer in England took me to a psychologist, and she said it'll take 20 years for the scars to sort of heal in this situation. And everyone's deeply scarred, but the situation's developing because of this film. Like, what the British press are trying to do is pit victim against victim, you know, which is a real sad state of affairs when you have people who have been acknowledged to have been brutalised and went through some of the worst conditions imaginable in that country, and then use them as a scapegoat to justify your own institutions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Conlon, and he is the subject of the new film In the Name of the Father, which stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Jerry Conlon. Jerry Conlon and several of his friends and family were basically framed for the bombing of two London pubs in, was it 1974?
It was 1974, and it wasn't basically framed, it was totally framed.
Thank you. And there was evidence that corroborated their story that was suppressed by the prosecution.
There was evidence the whole way through the thing. It was from the day after my arrest, the forensic and after scenes policemen had material at their fingertips that suggested they had got the wrong people. And even during my trial, the people who actually bombed Guildford and Woolwich left a bomb in Margaret Thatcher's constituency, which was an absolute replica of the bomb that they placed in Guildford without a detonator. And the forensic people who had just given evidence the day before on behalf of the prosecution in my case went and examined that bomb and then wrote a thesis saying that the people who have done the Guildford and Woolwich pub bombings are still at large, and they did not reveal that evidence to our defence. The police acted totally dishonourable, and so did the defence, or so did the prosecution in our case.
And even when the real bombers confessed to the bombing,
the real,
it was ignored.
When the Balcombe Street people were arrested, they were asked by the heads, Jim Neville, Peter Imbert, in the interrogation, what was the first bombings you did in this country? And they said, the first bombings we did in this country, you put innocent people in prison for. And they proceeded to give an enormous amount of detail. The police chose to do nothing about that. When the Balcombe Street people then got in touch with an MP, they were charged with Guildford and Woolwich and were charged for several months. They were then taken to a special court hearing where the charges, seven murder charges, were then dropped against them, with the statement from the DPP, who is your equivalent of your DA, stating that they did not want to burden the jury with too many charges. They then kept in several complex conspiracy charges, which those people were found not guilty of. The Balcombe Street people, or the IRA unit, then used their trial as a platform to highlight the injustice it had suffered us and the corruption of the British police and the British judiciary. And on the basis of that, we were given an appeal.
Jerry, you've said that you don't want to go through your whole life just being known as one of the Guildford Four. What have you been doing lately?
I've been campaigning. 2 weeks after I got out of prison, I was in Washington campaigning on behalf of other victims of injustice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've been doing. But I feel that, or I felt that I had to fulfill my father's promise, which was to let the world know what had happened to him. And the two mediums for doing that is literature and the cinema. After this movie's over, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I will always be involved in human rights issues, that's for sure, because I know what it's like to fall foul of the law when you're innocent.
Jerry Conlon's autobiography, In the Name of the Father, is the basis of the new movie of the same name. The director of the film, Jim Sheridan, will be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the writer and director of In the Name of the Father. We talk with Jim Sheridan about basing his film on the story of Jerry Conlon, who was wrongly convicted of being an IRA terrorist. The movie stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Jerry Conlon. Emma Thompson plays the lawyer who reopens the case. And Simpsons fans, tonight's the premiere of The Critic, another primetime cartoon series created by the former head writers of The Simpsons. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has met with key Democratic leaders at the White House. It's a follow-up to last night's State of the Union speech. Speaker of the House Tom Foley was upbeat about the president's address. UPI's Bill Small reports.
The morning after Mr. Clinton's State of the Union address, there was the predictably positive assessment from the Democratic Speaker of the House, Tom Foley.
All indications are there's an extraordinary national consensus that the president's, the issues presented and the focus he gave to his speech are on the right track.
In fact, says Foley, he thinks even Senate Republican leader Bob Dole had mellowed overnight, criticizing virtually all Clinton policies right after the speech, but sounding, in Foley's words, dramatically more bipartisan this morning. Foley and other Democratic House leaders were here to discuss ways to move health care reform legislation through the House, with markup beginning sometime after Easter. Bill Small at the White House.
Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole is still warning that there really is no health care crisis, as President Clinton says. Dole says that the president's health care reform programs are in trouble, even with Democrats. The White House says it's too early to start counting votes. Several Southern Africa leaders have agreed on a plan to end fighting in Lesotho. African National Congress President Nelson Mandela and the South African President F.W. de Klerk attended the strategy session in Botswana. The leaders have also decided to set up a regional task force. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
The significance of this meeting goes well beyond the problems of Lesotho. In essence, they provided the excuse for an historic act of reconciliation between South Africa and the frontline states. The sight of Nelson Mandela, F.W. de Klerk and Robert Mugabe sitting together in a crowded conference room symbolized the new reality, with South Africa no longer the pariah, but rather the regional superpower whose help is essential in dealing with local conflicts. Both President de Klerk and Nelson Mandela spoke of their common desire to contribute to peace and stability in the Southern African region, an area which Pretoria deliberately destabilized for years. Nelson Mandela said it was an occasion on which they could rise above the political quarrels at home.
Fergal Keane reporting. The United Nations says Iraq has revealed a lot about its weapons. A spokesman for the world body says Baghdad wants to get rid of the crippling UN oil embargo. The UN says Baghdad has agreed to accept a requirement for long-term weapons monitoring. Before Iraq can sell oil again, the UN must certify Baghdad has declared and destroyed all of its banned mass destruction weapons. Weapons inspectors still don't trust Baghdad. German and Saudi officials raided a German freighter at a Saudi port earlier this month. They took chemicals intended for rocket fuel production in Iraq. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 12.5 points to close at an even 3,908. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR. Romania has become the first nation to enroll in NATO's Partnership for Peace program. Romania's foreign minister signed the documents at NATO headquarters today in Brussels, Belgium. The minister says he hopes the action is a good one for the future of Romania's relations with the West. The Partnership for Peace program is intended to draw Eastern European nations closer to NATO allies without granting them full membership. The new United Nations commander in Bosnia, General Michael Rose, has promised his forces will do whatever they can to get relief supplies to where they are needed. The general spoke after a meeting with Bosnian leaders in Sarajevo. The BBC's Paul Adams reports.
This was General Rose's first formal encounter with members of the Bosnian government. His brief walkabout in the streets of Sarajevo beforehand suggested that he's anxious to restore a measure of confidence in the UN's presence here. But the Bosnian Prime Minister, Haris Silajic, struck a pessimistic note. Under the terms of its present mandate, he said, the UN is simply unable to help. In order to get help where it's needed most, he said, the UN should be prepared to bomb anyone standing in its way.
Priority number one is to free the humanitarian corridors into our towns and villages. If not, we are going to have a humanitarian catastrophe in Bosnia very, very soon.
General Rose wouldn't be drawn on what he thought of Mr. Silajic's appeal for airstrikes, but said he didn't expect to see any changes in his mandate in the near future.
Paul Adams reporting. Palestinian and Israeli negotiators have continued their surprise round of peace talks in Cairo. Negotiators from both sides have met with Palestinian Liberation Organization Chairman Yasser Arafat. They also concluded a second round of talks on the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and Jericho. The flurry of talks comes while hope is growing Palestinians will soon begin to govern themselves. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the first part of our show, we heard from Jerry Conlon, who was unjustly convicted in England of being an IRA terrorist, along with his friend Paul Hill, his aunt Annie McGuire, and his father. Conlon's autobiography is the basis of the new film In the Name of the Father. My guest Jim Sheridan wrote and directed the film. The film stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Conlon. Emma Thompson plays the lawyer who reopens the case and proves their innocence. Director Jim Sheridan and actor Daniel Day-Lewis had worked together before on the film My Left Foot. In the Name of the Father is as much about a father-son relationship as it is about politics. In this scene, Conlon's father, played by Peter Postlethwaite, has just been imprisoned as part of the bombing conspiracy. Jerry feels angry and guilty about his father's imprisonment, but he's still rebelling against his father.
Why are you looking at me like that?
What?
Why are you looking at me like that?
Like what?
Why do you always follow me? Why do you always follow me when I do something wrong? Why can't you follow me when I do something right?
What are you talking about?
Huh? What am I talking about? I'm talking about the medal.
What medal?
The medal I won at football. And you could only see what I was doing wrong. I could never do anything good enough for you. And after the game, you came up to me and you said, Jerry, did you foul the ball?
This is shock.
And that's when I started the rob. The proof that I was no good.
I asked Jim Sheridan what made him decide to do a film about Jerry Conlon.
Lots of things, but to round out just the conversation with Jerry and to show you the kind of anger where I was coming from, Jerry got out of prison and his lawyer, Garrett Pierce, asked that they be given psychotherapy. And the only people who did this were the RAF, I think. And they said they couldn't do it because of the IRA connection. And Garrett Pierce said, well, you did it for the hostages from Beirut. And these people repeated and said, we can't do it because of the IRA connection. Now, Garrett Pierce then pointed out to them that these had been cleared in the court of any connection. But that didn't work. So the only healing that's been done is by my film. There's no apologies coming from the other side. And there's no sense of wanting to heal this case. All they have to say is they're sorry. And Peter Imbert, who Jerry mentioned as getting the information from the IRA that they did the bombing, retired as head of the Metropolitan Police as Sir Peter Imbert. So you have that on the one hand, and on the other, these poor... Jerry is in many ways still 20. Paul Hill is still 20. Annie McGuire is very angry at Jerry, understandably in certain regards, but I think wrongly. And, you know, nobody is looking at the overall situation and saying, how come you change things by first apologising for the wrong. So nobody had apologised and nobody, and the Court of Appeal was dragging on and nothing was happening. And I saw this story and then I saw the fact that Jerry's father followed him And that really crowned it for me. I saw this man who was like Orpheus in the underworld going in after his son into hell to try and rescue him. And he gets pulled into the vortex and pulled down. And then I thought, this is amazing. It's like a fairy tale, but it's different to a fairy tale because fairy tales end happily. And in this case, Giuseppe didn't get out. He died inside. That's the only difference.
The story in the movie focuses in a fascinating way about the father, Giuseppe, and the son, Jerry Conlon. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, Jerry Conlon sees his father as meek and as something of an embarrassment. And he sees his father's lack of confidence as responsible for a lot of Jerry's own problems. Jerry Conlon's book doesn't focus on the father-son relationship nearly to the extent that your movie does. Did a lot of that come from talking to Jerry, or is a lot of that stuff that you added in for dramatic reasons?
Well, it's a combination, you know. Because I wanted a father-son story, and once I focused that, I asked Jerry an awful lot of questions, you know, as you can imagine. Like, we spent weeks and weeks together before I start filming. And I drew certain of the facts from Jerry, and I kind of tried to pull it out of him. And you must understand that there were a lot of things Jerry didn't want to face, you know. I mean, his father was in jail, not because of him, because of the authorities. But somewhere, you know, you have to hold yourself responsible. Mm-hmm. So Jerry had this, like, well of, like, guilt to deal with. And I didn't want to add to that, and I certainly didn't want to victimize him again. And I think that, you know, in very many strange ways, we have become close in a funny way. We've argued and fought, just like Giuseppe and Jerry, just like Jerry with his own father and the characters in the film. So, and in other ways, Jerry has taught me things. So between me and Jerry, the relationship is like, you know, I suppose, brotherly, father and son, argumentative. And that's the way you can't draw a clear line. So I took quite a bit from my own relationship with my own father emotionally and tied it to Jerry's story. But, you know, and fathers and sons are the same the world over. So it's a combination of, you know, forcing Jerry to tell me a bit more and drawing on my own stuff.
Daniel Day-Lewis plays the part of Jerry Conlon. You work together in My Left Foot.
Mm-hmm.
Was he immediately enthusiastic about taking on this role, or did you have to talk him into it?
Yeah, I had to talk him into it. You know, it's, you know, basically, like, if you're an actor, it's worse even than a director. I get people ringing me up and they're giving me scripts and their life will change, you know, is their concept if you do the script. So it becomes this terrible onus on you to read this stuff, and you read it and it doesn't even make it past page 5. And, you know, they've spent months working on it. So that's what it's like for actors, mostly reading scripts. So I was very careful not to give Daniel a script and to let him get the full impact of the story. And I told him the story. I prefer to tell stories than...
Are you very good at that? Are you very good at putting a story across?
Well, I think we, you know, the Irish have that thing of being good at stories. I'm not sure that it's such a... It's a great talent in certain regards, but it's also a very dangerous one. But I am good at, yes, telling stories. But I then, you know, and then I would involve Daniel in meeting Jerry and whatever. And then Daniel was offered another few films, you know, where he would earn 3 times the amount of money. And, you know, it was the same with myself. You know, I could have earned an awful lot more by doing a, you know, commercial film. But we just decided that this was more important and we should do it. But we don't want to be clapped on the back for that, you know, because it's really painful to be doing films that are just commercial and, you know, you're into. And, you know, it's a hard medium if you're sensitive in certain regards, because you're getting up every day to try and push this stuff that you don't believe in along. So once you get something you believe in, you'll do it for, you know, a tenth of the price and feel 10 times as good about it. But, you know, I think, we were happy to do it.
My guest is Jim Sheridan, director of In the Name of the Father. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
back with director and screenwriter Jim Sheridan. Are you still living in Ireland?
I'm living in Dublin now. I lived in America for 7 or 8 years, but now I live in Ireland. Yeah.
Well, what kind of impact has your film had in Ireland?
You know, every time somebody asks you a question like what kind of impact it has, if you say that it's going to be, it's either going to be second to Jurassic Park or it's going to surpass it, you know, it sounds like it's a boast, but it has a huge impact in Ireland. I think it has an impact for, I think in many ways it has a very healthy impact because it confronts the situation openly up front and it says a lot of things that needed to be said. And it says them in a non-violent way. And people need that. That's the stories that need to be told. The Irish story has never been told. The writers, news agency, has controlled the world media, and especially America, since the Second World War. And, you know, Americans have and British interests have been very similar, very close for all that time. I think basically until the collapse of Russia. And I think you'll find that a lot of regional conflicts changed their perspective now that the Russian threat is no longer there.
Is your father still alive?
No, he died about a week ago.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Had
he seen the movie? I was just wondering, it sounds like you worked out a lot of your feelings about your relationship with your father in the film.
Yeah. Well, of course I did, you know what I mean? Up to I did that film, there was a tape running in my head, you know, which was that all fathers were bullies and tough and, you know, that's the Irish father figure as portrayed in literature by the writers. And I don't care if we have genius writers in Ireland. I think it's a bullshit story. Most fathers are quite good. My father, of course, I had some small arguments with him. I had, you know, grown up rows when I was 17. But even now, like, when I read the papers, like, it's like as if I was fighting him all the time. And, you know, the truth of the matter was, most of the times I got on with him, and there was a truce, I suppose, you know, in many ways. Until lately, when I told him I was doing this film, or just before that, and we talked about my brother, one of my brothers who died, and we got a lot closer. And then when I started to make the film, he was very happy, because somewhere deep down, all the father figures were him. And on the premiere night in Dublin, he was over the moon, totally happy. And it was like a reconciliation, this film. It was quite strange, actually, you know, to be burying your father when you had this film out called In the Name of the Father.
Had he been sick when you were making it?
No, not at all, really. It was a surprise thing. He was always well. He got terminal pneumonia. But I suppose, you know, in many ways, you know, good things come out of interior change, you know. And once I decided I was going to make a story about a good father, you know, it's like an antennae. You pick up the story out there. So like Jerry and, you know, although an awful lot of bad came out of the Guildford story, at least one, you know, me and my dad and whatever that, you know, reconciliation. It wasn't like an earth-shattering thing, but it was nice for me to have before he died. And if it heals in other ways, this story, you know, it'll be great. And I think that a healing process needs to start. But the English and the British have never contextualized the means within which Northern Ireland can be healed. Now, if it takes us to contextualize it, if it takes the victims at last to fight back and put a new context, then so be it. But you realize, if you ask any victims out there, be they women who are raped, be they children who are abused, be they nations that are abused, in the end, it's the victims that frame the healing process, not the victimizers. The victimizers only see that they're right. That they have to hold that, otherwise they collapse into self-hatred. And we don't want that to happen in relation to England. We actually think that you need a healing framework for the future. You need to visualise a future with peace. And we'll fight the IRA. You know, I mean, our film takes a stand against the IRA. And nobody has come up to us and said, you know, well done in England to that. They've only attacked us for bringing us the truth to light.
Has making this film made you more political?
Yes, it has in certain regards. It's made me more positively anti violence, you know, but it's made me realize that violence occurs. It's an inadequate means of dialogue violence. It happens when people decide to vent their anger in horrific, obscene ways, or when they feel that they're not allowed to vent it in other ways. And I think it's a sad situation more than anything, you know. It's like, it's just a very, and we feel in Ireland, you know, that 99% of Irish people are non-violent. In fact, the least violent race in the world in many ways. You know, they say the fighting Irish. That's only because the rest of Europe robbed the world for hundreds of years. We were the only ones that didn't. And every 40 or 50 years, five or 10 people died fighting England or whatever. And they were called the fighting Irish because of that. So when the people who colonized the world framed the debate, they put words attached to us. I don't want those words to be attached to the Irish anymore. I realize in many ways that, you know, the Irish are like children also, you know, but children grow up and it's time we grew up, you know. I do feel that, and it's time, you know, the Irish in America got on the side of trying to build a peaceful framework and get the Catholic population of Northern Ireland, who are 20 to 50% unemployed, some work. You know, we need a new frameworks rather than the old trotted out cliches that have been coming out for the last 50 years. I don't know. I suppose I am political.
Jim Sheridan co-wrote and directed In the Name of the Father. Here's Sinead O'Connor from the soundtrack of the film.
I hope you're happy now. I could never make you so. You were a hard man, no harder in this world. You made me cold, and you made
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, are you looking back on President Clinton's State of the Union address?
We are indeed. We'll be hearing about what the president said, what's likely to happen in the Congress next with health care reform. And we'll also be hearing the reactions of three Midwesterners whom Linda Wertheimer actually met during her drive out through the American midsection last year to hear what they thought of the State of the Union address. Also today, we'll be talking with Francis Crick, the Nobel laureate, one of those who, he was with Watson when they discovered DNA. He's written a book called The Astonishing Hypothesis, which is about consciousness, in which he says simply that everything we perceive and interpret is just the result of a bunch of chemical reactions.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on ABC, two writers from The Simpsons and executive producer James L. Brooks team up again with a new primetime cartoon series. It's called The Critic and features the voice of John Lovitz as a film reviewer who hosts a show on a New York TV station. Our New York-based TV critic, David Bianculli, has a review. Here's a clip featuring The Critic hosting his movie review show.
Let's start with Arnold Schwarzenegger's latest film, Rabbi P.I. It's the story of a Chicago cop who goes undercover as a Hasidic Jew.
Eat lead, Rabbi.
Sorry, that's not kosher.
It's been 4 years since The Simpsons was spun off from The Tracy Ullman Show. And in those 4 years, TV has tried and failed to come up with another clever cartoon comedy. Remember Capital Critters, The Fish Police, and Family Dog? If you don't, it's just as well. But The Critic is different. If you love The Simpsons, you'll love The Critic, too. The former producers of The Simpsons, Al Jean and Mike Rice, have written a series that works on as many levels as that wonderful show. The pop culture references, the many and loony characters, they're all here. In terms of the humor, the film review satires are the easy part. Easy, but still funny.
Welcome to Coming Attractions. Tonight, We'll be reviewing Family Affair, the motion picture. Just look who got $8 million to play Mr. French.
Buffy, Zodi, for your lunch I have made peanut butter and banana sandwiches.
Would you make a sandwich for my doll, Mrs. Beasley?
Yeah, sure. That's exactly what I feel like doing. Of course I can get together a little sandwich for your stupid little doll. Hang on a sec.
What I love most about The Critic, though, is how they've created a whole world for Lovitz's Jay Sherman outside of his on-air show. At work, he has to deal with a station owner who looks and sounds a little like Ted Turner and isn't too happy with Jay's opinions.
Why the hell do you have to be so critical?
I'm a critic.
No, your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
What if I don't like them?
That's what good's for.
In his private life, Jay is a single parent, and his own parents make fun of him. So do most other people. Neighborhood kids call him King Dork, and he has only one close friend, an actor who sounds like Crocodile Dundee. Well, most of the time, anyway.
What's wrong, mate?
I'm afraid if my girlfriend meets you, she won't want me anymore.
You've got a point there. Women love me no matter what I do. I've tried not shaving, I've tried not bathing.
I've even tried talking like this!
No use.
Any cartoon show that tips its hat to Bullwinkle can't be all bad. And The Critic, except for its dull opening sequence, is almost all good. Most of the celebrity voices are impersonated, but one real celebrity lends a hand tonight, in a scene where Jay takes a beautiful young actress out to dinner.
Oh, great. They sat us in the critics section.
Pelican brief, more like turkey too long.
Even Satan himself would love this angel hair pasta. It's a goodbye, and so goodbye from Mr. Good Guy, Gene Shalit.
As a matter of fact, if I have to be critical of The Critic, it'd be about the absurdity of tonight's plotline, which has a starlet seducing Jay in order to get a good review. In almost 20 years as a critic, I've never once had that happen. But I'm still hoping.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease, research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last time we heard from Elvis Costello on Fresh Air, he was collaborating with the String Quartet. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us why he's reunited with his band, The Attractions, and with Nick Lowe, his first record producer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.